Okay, we're good.
I thought maybe you don't have to wear your mask if you're the.
I know, I was saying before, I was debating, like, when I'm giving it,
no,
every week I was like, what's our level of whatever, personal thing, and not even, has not even the corona anymore. I mean, it is a little bit, but anyway, today I'm giving it out. Okay, good to see you. Today we're going to do the last little stretch, very little stretch of a description of the backdrop to the party and the setting of the party. And that is the drinking. It gets its own little mini section. We're in Perek Aleph, and we are in Pasuk Zion. So Pasuk Zion, we're going to read the two psukim about the drinking. V'ashkot b'chlei zahav, v'chelim mikelim shonim. I can almost not say it without doing the trap from Purim.
Right.
You know, that's like the way you read it. Yeah, v'yein malchut rav k'yad hamelech. The drinking was in golden vessels, and these kelim were from kelim shonim. I always thought of it as different dishes, different vessels, and we'll talk about that in a second. And the wine was, like, the royal wine was a lot, as per the hand of the king. We'll do the second pasuk too, and then we'll discuss. Vashtia kadat, ein ones. And the drinking was, it's interesting, hashkot and hashtia, is two different words. We're not actually going to talk about that, but if you have any thoughts, feel free to share. The drinking was according to the rules. No one was forced, ki chein yisad hamelech, because that's what the king had established, al kol rav beito. Upon all, for all masters of the house, lasot kirtzon ish veish, to do according to each person wanted. So, in order to, we have to delve into these two psukim a little bit, and even to understand the pshat, we kind of have to explain a little bit of what it's talking about. So, we're going to do actually the Gemara straight first, at least a chunk of the Gemara straight first, and then we're going to, and that's one level of understanding, and then we're going to go another level deeper to understand the Gemara a little more. So, we have, we're still on Daf Yud Aleph. The last page of the English of the art scroll, little number four there. And it's going to discuss each phrase here. Vashko, bechlei zahav, bechelim, mechelim shonim. So what's the famous drash on this? The Kamon Beis Hamikdash, right? We already established that that Ahasuerus made the party to celebrate the end of the Beis Hamikdash, that he's wearing the Bidei Kahuna. And this is the source of the fact that he used the Kalim of the Beis Hamikdash. What is exactly the source, though, from the words? Mishunim mi baylei. It should have said mishunim, which means diverse, according to the language of the Megillah. If it was trying to say a variety of vessels, if it was trying to use, if the pshat meant an illustration of the riches and extravagance of the party, then it would have said these vessels that he used, these golden cups, presumably these dishes, were a variety of different types, that he had all different kinds of cups. Why did it say shonim? So Amar Rava yatsa yasta batkol. According to Rava, a bat kol went out at this party and said to them, Rishonim kalu mipnei chelim. The earlier ones, the first people, referring to Belshazzar, according to the commentary in the Gemara, they were kalu mipnei chelim. V'atem shonim bahem. And you are repeating them. Kalu mipnei chelim. Kalu is lashon kilayon, like destruction. And the Gemara is pointing out, what's the difficulty in the pasuk that the Gemara is noticing and commenting on? Where did you get this from? We know shonim, it already said, should have said mishunim, diverse, and shonim has different implication. What is the kalum ifne kelim? Where is the kilayon coming from? Maybe it just means kelim, or just vessels. Kelim means kelim. Right, so it noticed, kelim, mi kelim, shonim. It uses the word twice. Why should the Megillah bother saying kelim twice? It could have just said v'ha kelim shonim or mishunim, and the dishes were diverse or they were unusual. But instead, it says the kelim were from kelim shonim, and so the Gemara says one word kelim is lashon kilayon, is hinting to the destruction that took place because of the actual kelim of the Beis Hamikdash the first time. The first time Belshazzar, and again, we're not learning Daniel inside. We could actually, I didn't copy that. I'm orbiting my Tanakh today, but the story in Daniel goes that Belshazzar was previously the ruler, and he made a party also. We talked about the timeline, how he also thought that, you know, the Gullus was over, and he also took out the Kalim of the Beis Hamikdash, and ultimately that ended in his demise. He was killed at the end of that party because he was using the Kalim of the Beis Hamikdash. So they were Kalim Mikalim Shonim Achashverosh. Someone was already destroyed because of these Kalim Shonim, and here you are, the implication of shonim is lashon of repetition, is also the same shorash. And so the Baskol came out and said, why are you repeating the same mistake? Someone was already destroyed because of these things, and you're going and doing the same thing. That's ridiculous. What are you doing? Which, of course, tells us that we should make sure not to make other people's mistakes. Yeah, and someone else asked a previous time, like, where did he get these from? It was his own accomplishment, his own grand, you know, that he was this dictator. He plundered them himself. No, he didn't plunder them himself. He got them from Belshazzar, who got them from Nebuchadnezzar. There was a certain lineage, not just of who was the ruler, but which wasn't really the lineage anyway. But these kelim had been passed down.
They saved it for, like, every time somebody was celebrating the end of 7 years.
Well, that's when they took it out, because what else would you do when you're celebrating the end of the galus, you know, not ending?
Keeps happening over and over again.
Right. Right. So the message to us is, you know, history. Don't let history repeat itself. Right. Learn from previous mistakes and don't be ridiculous and make the same mistakes that are going to end in problems. Okay. So we have these unusual kelim. V'yayin malchut rav. Amar rav. Now here we're going to also look at the wording is going to indicate something. Amar rav. M'lamei shekol achad v'echad hishkahu yayin shegadol himenu. B'shnayim. It teaches this phrase, yayin malchut rav, teaches that each person was given to drink wine that was greater than their bishanim, greater than their years, like older than themselves. And the idea is that it should have said harbe. The Mefarshim and the Gemara and on the Agadah say that it should have said the yain malchut harbe. There was a lot of wine, but he said rav because rav indicates the quality. It was greater in its quality, not only in its quantity. So they were mechuba. All the honorees didn't just get a lot of wine; they got special aged wine. And this is a theme I didn't choose to build on it a lot, but there we could have also spent even longer on Perek Aleph, talking about all the commentaries that elaborate on the extravagance of the party. I kind of felt like it's pretty apparent just from the shot that it was really, you know, extravagant, but Mefarshim and the Midrashim go on saying even more detailed about how fancy the party was. So this is another indication of how, you know, sophisticated the party was.
Is the point of extrapolating on the fanciness of the party in order to say come out against Achashverosh, or is it to come out against the Jews, or because it seems like I mean this was a very significant event, not in terms of just historically, but the repercussions of the event. So depending on which side you take, it's like. Like if the Jews were being held at fault for appearing at this very ostentatious event, then the right. More that you like press the point, the more you're like,
the more you emphasize how extravagant it is.
Right.
Yes and yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
I mean, there's also we've already mentioned a lot of the person that uses as a point against the Achashverosh.
Exactly. So it definitely illustrates both. 100%. We learn about Achashverosh and the backdrop to the story. We learn about the Jews and what they were actually participating in, for sure.
So what's the benefit of this?
So it's both. In other words, Achashverosh tells us who we're up against and what we're up against and what the cultural environment was at the time. And then our place in it, we're put in the middle of this. And in this galus, how were B'nai Yisrael relating to that and in attending this party? What were they drawn to? Okay, we're going to talk today a little bit more about the permissibility of attending this party and what they were connecting to. Okay, so yeah, we'll keep that in mind. Okay, and actually it's the next part of the Gemara from the next words. Vashtiya kadat. And the drinking was according to the rules, according to the law, right? In Israel we use the word dat is religion, dati lumi, all these kinds of things. My dat kadat. What is that?
Kadin.
Kadat v'kadin, right? It's the way it's supposed to be. Who's law? What law are we talking about here? So Amar Rabbi Hanan, Mishum Rabbi Meir, again we're in Gemara, I don't know if any Gemara's out. Yibbet Amalf, what does he say? Kadat Shel Torah, actually. Not necessarily according to their law, maybe, but that's not what the Gemara is saying, but according to the law of Torah. We use the word dat with regards to Judaism. Okay? In what way? What's that supposed to mean? Ma dat Shel Torah achila meruba mishtia. Apparently, according to the Gemara, Torah law says you should eat more than you drink. Okay? What? So we're going to see about that. Afsudato shel oto rasha achila meruba mishtia. Also, the party of this rasha guy, oto rasha, we don't even mention his name here, the eating was greater than the drinking.
Well, it's drinking alcoholic beverages.
Yeah.
Presumably that's what we're talking about, yes.
Yeah.
We're not talking about water, you know.
You don't see that in the description.
Right, that's why it's Drash.
It describes the alcohol.
Right, so isn't that interesting? And the Maharal goes on about why it doesn't elaborate on the food. If the food was more, and it was a party, and like you go to eat at a party, like why is it not...
I would like to know what this
meal. Well, I know, you're curious, right? I'm sure that meat, like,
yeah,
I don't know,
but,
right?
Yeah.
I don't know if they eat vegetables. But in other words...
Is there anything lately on kosher?
Okay. Okay, so this is the questions that we're going to do. We're going to talk about. Let's go to the Megillat Starim. I don't think I copied it for you. I copied the Rishon Lezion for you. So let's pause in the Gemara here, since we started bringing up some questions, and then we'll go back to it. Let's elaborate a little bit on these ideas. Okay, we know this Beis Mikdash idea, but the Yain Malchut Rav also just interesting point that the Gra says Pshat also means that like Kedat Malchut Rav. Kiyad Hamel. Kiyad Hamel means like the way kings used to drink. They would have a variety of different wines, not only a variety of dishes, but all different types of wine so people could choose what they wanted and have a lot of fancy options. But according to the Drash, Hashtiyah Kadat says in Gilt Starim that based on this Gemara, the Kadat Shal Torah, he says actually, if you who remembers, what was the premise of the Gilt Starim? What was the whole goal of the party?
To make the Jews sin.
That was his approach and opinion. And he says that this part, these two psukim, tell us one particular way that he tried to make them sin. Last time we talked about the environment, the ginat pitan, right? That had to do with something a little more suggestive than just the setting, right? He had these zonas wandering around. And here, it's talking about the food and drink. And he says something really, actually, I think it's surprising, that it was according to the Dat Shel Torah, like the Gemara says, in what way? That food was actually kosher. Now, the Midrash says the opposite. Shishar Hashem Rabba says it wasn't kosher.
But if the food was kosher, then that's a bigger taina against the Jews, because...
I would think the opposite. Why is it against the Jews?
Because it means that they were going along. First of all, when we're talking about Yisro Hayayim, the entire process, they had to be Jews, like, handling the wine.
Okay.
So they had to be... Making it.
So you're saying that means that Jews were involved in the preparation process of the meal, which is worse. Well, why is it worse if it was kosher?
I mean, if the whole meal is to celebrate the destruction and the hope for Jews, and the entire time you have Jews very heavily involved in the preparation, then that's really bad for us, because
right.
You're saying that they're submitting themselves to the foreign...
They're trying to facilitate Jews attending this celebration of the end of the...
Right, but
of
also
the...
it's an acknowledgement that in the victory of this foreign king and kingdom and culture over traditional Judaism.
Right, they're going along with it. So this is interesting. The Lubavitcher Rebbe says that this idea, this weird thing going on, where like it's following halacha, but obviously it's bad. So he says that because this Mordechai is called Mordechai HaYehudi, he says, what does this indicate that he's called HaYehudi? He says, it indicates this kind of higher level or broader level of being a Jew. Being a Jew isn't just following halacha. That there's halacha. Okay, can I go to the party? There's kosher food, there's kosher wine. Great, I can go to the party. It's exciting. It's an honor. It's the king. And there's even, where was it from? The Dibna Magid cites forget where he quoted it from. That says that there's actually an idea of attending a gathering of the royalty of Jewish king versus a non-Jewish king, so that you can know the difference between what is a Jewish king supposed to represent versus, and contrast it from experience, what is non-Jewish king like. That there's something to be said for going to a king's gathering. So maybe the Jews thought that they're supposed to go. It's a good thing to go. And look, there's kosher food, there's kosher wine. It's okay. So the Lubav Sharevi says, no, Mordechai HaYehudi, he was a Jew. He wasn't only a person who followed halacha. He was a person who's a Jew. He followed what he calls like a pietistic Judaism, where there's the value that's greater and the ethics that's greater than just what the letter of the law says. But like, really, what are you doing here? You know, and that we're supposed to learn that we have to have both. We have to have the letter of the law and follow halacha, but we also have to have a sense and the ethics and the values of what Judaism is supposed to be all about, and not get too, you know, stuck in one or the other. Okay, so the Gel Starim goes on, and he says that what was Achashverosh's goal and Achashverosh's purpose in having kosher food there? So you kind of suggested already, you know, maybe in involving the Jews in the preparation, he was trying to kind of like grab them and harness them into his plan of being in charge and make them feel important that they're helping out and they're allowed to come, but really he's, you know, making them submissive to his power. But the Megillat Esther says something else, which is really interesting. He says that that what happened, if he had kosher food and kosher wine at this party, there was also non-kosher food, non-kosher wine at this party. And let's just go to the next pasuk first to understand better. It said, we said that the shtia was according to the law, not forced. That's the king had established. Lasot kirson ish ve'ish. Okay? Let's go back to Gemara for a minute. Gemara's going to explain these last couple of phrases, and then we're going to see how the Megillat Esther expounds on this idea of it being according to the law of the Torah. So we said that it was according to Judaism, Jewish values or laws, that there's supposed to be more eating than drinking, which, by the way, is a reference to Karbanos, actually, which we'll talk about in a minute. It says, Ein onis, the person wasn't forced. Rabbi Elazar melamid shekol echad v'echad hishkahu miyayin medinato. It says they didn't have to. Any one particular way indicates that each person was given a drink that was like the wine of where they came from. They were used to drinking from their own medina. And then the Megillah says, lasot kirson ish va'ish, according to each person's will, ratzon. Amar Rava, lasot kirtzon Mordechai v'Haman. Rava says this isn't just any ish va'ish. It specifically refers to two people called ish. Mordechai dechtiv ish Yehudi. Mordechai is called ish. He's called ish Yehudi. We see later in the Megillah. Haman, Haman is also entitled this term ish. He's called a different kind of ish, and ish tzar v'oyev, an enemy. Both these people are called ish. It means that it should be according to the way Mordechai wanted it and the way according to the way that Haman wanted it. So it says in Megillat Esther, let's put these ideas together. Why would Ahasuerus want this party to be the way Haman wanted and the way Mordechai wanted? If he's trying to get all the Jews to sin, why should he want anything the way Mordechai wanted it? Right? He's just the way he likes Haman. Haman's his kind of guy. He should make the party like a Haman kind of party, or like his officers. What's with Mordechai? What does he care for? So he says part of his plan in making the Jews sin was that he knew the Jews could only be held accountable if they chose to sin. Now, okay, coming to the party is a choice also, but he wanted to make it the easiest way so Jews should be able to choose their own free will to sin. And so he purposely had an option of kosher food and an option of non-kosher food. So it'd be kirtzon ish va'ish. Whoever wants to be like Haman can be like Haman. Whoever wants to be like Mordechai could be like Mordechai. You want to eat treif? Go for it. You want to kosher? Okay, fine. That's your choice. But if you're going to eat treif, you're going to be at fault here. It has nothing to do with me. I just put it there. The Jews, it's going to be your fault if you do something wrong. So this idea of making them sin is not just, maybe it's, he's certainly not kosher food. The Midrash, I think it's like an interesting machlokas altogether. The Midrash and Rabbah says, no, dafka, he had not kosher food. But here, the Gemara says, no, he had kosher food. It wasn't, either he made them sin directly by saying, here, eat non-kosher, or maybe he was a little more sly about it and said, maybe you want to eat non-kosher. And this is something whoever attended, why were they attending in the first place, had to really be aware of themselves and consciousness over here of, you know, who's choosing what and why. So so this was the ploy. Okay.
Well, I mean, it could be that there were a lot of Jews that had political power. So it could be that they came because they felt like they had to, but then when they're already there, it's a matter of like what you choose to do. Like once they're already
right. Now, there's an end. It was all the Jews of Shushan were invited. It wasn't like just for the officials, but in the purest sense, it could be there might have been some people who came out of a feeling of obligation, and then they could choose kosher food, and they, you know.
If Yaakov the shoemaker doesn't go, nobody's gonna notice. But if like you know, the secretary of whatever.
Okay, so if someone chose to go full-heartedly, they could do that. If someone felt like they had to go, either way, people had the choice. Now, it's interesting because the Maharal had another approach. Who remembers what was the Maharal's approach of the whole party? What was the whole premise that we elaborated on? Megillat Esther said he was trying to make them sin. What was the other philosophy behind the party?
That he was...
What was Ahasuerus trying to do with all this stuff?
Trying to tap into somehow...
Right. Goal, like, make it his own type of
right. He wanted to be like the heavenly kingdom on earth, but like the Tumah version, right? So it's not unrelated to making them sin. He still had this like evil plot involved, but it was more self-centered, and he wanted to be like God on earth. And according to the Maharal, what's this kirtzon ish va'ish personal? But he also talks about bechira. He says just like Hashem made a world of bechira, So his party should be a party of Bechira. It's a godly party. If the God, if the Jewish people's God... all the colored pretty things and his onas and all the things, then like, is he really trying to give him a, you know, an honest Bechira here? He has a bit of an agenda. It's not really like Hashem, who obviously, who gives us Bechira, and it's our real Bechira point of this is free, fully free choice. He was giving him Bechira with like a little bit of a nudge in one direction, but not too much of a nudge, enough that like they should really be held accountable.
Well,
if they sin.
It's a lot smarter. I mean, because when you also think about the conversation between Haman and his wife, you know, she's saying back to him, anytime that somebody tries to destroy the Jews, they get back on them. So Achashverosh, he could look back on the, you know, his ancestors and see how they try to pressure the Jews and to force them, like, what's his name, Nebuchadnezzar, he made everybody bow down to some idol, but that didn't really help him. Whereas it seems like a lot smarter to do it from a place of...
he's not forced. Mm-hmm.
And
he's trying to be more strategic about it.
Friend, and they feel a sense of like reliance on him and camaraderie.
Right, so this is a lot more strategic, I think, than like Jewish history. There was a lot of blatant anti-Semitism and on different kinds of anti-Semitism we could talk about, but often it was really clear and straight out, and here it was more conniving, which also plays into our whole discussion of the personality of Ahasuerus and like, who was he, what kind of person was he?
Why is Ahasuerus then willing, a couple of chapters later, to destroy the Jews?
What do you mean? Because of what Chana's saying?
Yeah, I'm saying...
Well, it wasn't working. Like, even because, to me it seems more like Ahasuerus wasn't necessarily targeting the Jews, but he was trying to like make a singular culture.
According to this, he was targeting the Jews. It depends on what approach you take to it. There's different sources suggest that idea about singular culture is definitely true, but this like specific Megillat Esther is more Dafka trying to make them sin. He wanted, you know what? It's like Balak and Bilam is a really good example where like they tried to make the Jewish people sin. Really, they wanted to destroy the Jewish people, but like they didn't want it to be their fault. So if they open the door for the Jewish people to sin, then Hashem will be mad at them anyway, and then it won't be their fault that they win them in the war, you know, that they beat them out. Well, it'll be the Jews' fault, and they'll deserve it, and Hashem will allow them to win.
Well, traditionally, Jews have their own separate culture. Like you go to, Williamsburg in Brooklyn, and it's a completely different world than if you go to Times Square. So, it could be that he was targeting the Jews, but with this intent, not just to, like, make them sin, but to make them, you know, his brand of citizen.
Right, so we didn't actually get into that theme. Again, there are sources that talk about that idea, and that's probably true as well.
Well, I mean, they don't necessarily have to be conflicting.
Right, exactly, definitely. Okay, so we have our Ish
Ba'ish. Yeah. Oh, are you about to talk about Ish Ba'ish?
The Maharal more? So I'm saying the Maharal's whole premise was that, I think we said it already, that the Maharal's premise was that he wanted to make his kingdom like an earthly, like a godly kingdom on earth with a little side of Tumah to it. And so just like Hashem creates the world with Bechira, he made his place, so his party with Bechira, where people could do as they want. Just to explain a little bit background, we said we need to explain a little background to understand even the Peshat. What does it mean that it was Ein Ones? Well, what might they have been forced to do that they weren't forced to do? I don't know. I've never been to a party where someone was, like, forced to drink.
Exactly.
About.
I mean, it sounds so reasonable, right? Like, oh, it's definitely...
Of course.
No, right, of course.
Why would anyone...
The whole thing was so totally, wildly exaggerated and over the top, and then here we come in and hear this, but it was completely reasonable.
Right. But anyway, to me, it's just strange. You know, why is it even said? It doesn't have to be reasonable because it's obvious. There's no such thing as a party where people are forced to drink. Like, it's out. And dafka, if it's Kertzon Ish Ba'ish, if it's Bechira, then, like, why should you even have to mention that they're not forced? Because you wouldn't even think that they have to be forced. What's going on here? So Rashi says that it's based in Persian culture. And I looked it up, and I couldn't find secular historical sources that say exactly what Rashi says, but it did provide a little historical environment, like, context that explains it somewhat. So first, Rashi says. Rashi says that it was a thing. In this era of Persian history, they used to have a gigantic cup full of how many revises? Rashi says 22 revises. I did not measure it out. Sorry, didn't have time for that.
I'm imagining.
I'll tell you what I imagine. My uncle is a Polish ger, And he has like the Polish persona still in him. He's like a really big guy. And he has in his dining room this humongous goblet. Like, this is how I paint. It must be exactly what it looked like. I don't know where he got it from or why he has it. But we like joke because he's on perm. It's like literally this wide. And like the drinking part of it before the stemware is literally this tall. This is what it must have. Again, I didn't measure out. What's that? It's like a statue, but it's a goblet. Look, again, at home, I was going to, like, look up how big Ravis is and, like, do the math of how many. I didn't have that.
But physically
bigger?
Was it that long ago? How long was it, Megillah? Isn't it interesting? Maybe they were physically bigger than that.
I don't think... listen, the Persians are compared to bears in Sefer Daniel. So the Persians are compared to bears in Sefer Daniel. It could be to a certain extent there was, like, a certain body type that was... I don't know. I don't think they were giants. There's nothing that I'm aware of that indicates that they were, like, crazy, miraculously gigantic. Could be they were big guys. And this actually supports that, because what does Rashi say they used to do from this giant cup? So now you can look in your source sheet. I copied you a different commentary called Rishon Lezion on the words Vashti Akadat. Okay, and it's basing on the Midrash. It says, Nira, Shekevan Lamam Ramzal, as it says, the Chachamim say in the Midrash, Amra Blevi Kachaya Tachsis Anshe Paras. Hayalhem kos echad machzik kaf bet reviot, 22 revises, v'chulei, v'hayu mashkin bo lechol echad v'echad. Each person had to drink. I must have heard this Rashi somewhere, and I felt like each person took a sip from this giant cup. That's not what the Rishon Lezion says. He says each person had to drink it. V'afilu hu mate bo, even if he drank so much alcohol that he died. That's what they used to do in Asian person, according to this. And this is what Rashi doesn't elaborate as much as this commentary. That's why I'm bringing you this one. He's very specific. Vafilu mishtageya, who even if he went crazy because he drank too much alcohol, they would make him drink from it. This was like a thing. It's like very guy, like male, macho, you know. You like picture, like, it's crazy, like a bar scene.
Extreme.
Yeah. Really crazy culture. Aval, Achashverosh, lo ichniso talkos bisudatom. Achashverosh didn't make anyone do that. Yeah, you could do what you want. Ish, your coat's on, ish for ish, right? You could have your bachir. I won't make you do that. Don't worry. Tosh, that's like ridiculous. But in those times, that was actually a statement. It was a big deal because it was so normal. Misha who wrote Selishto v'chulei, goes on quoting the Medrash. If someone wanted to drink, they could drink. If they didn't want, they didn't have to. Kedichiv enonis. They weren't forced to adkan. It seems like they did have this cup that you could drink from. In other words, they didn't want to look stingy either. It was kind of a balance, because we just said, yeah, this extravagant party. And if the cultural norm was to have this huge cup and tons of wine, everyone would have to drink from it, and even have it all, it wouldn't look so good, right? It would look like he's kind of stingy. You don't have so much wine in your kingdom to do the big cup thing. Okay, so he had it, but they didn't have to drink from it. Okay, that's basically the context that this is coming from. And when I looked it up, I didn't find this exact description of a giant cup. What I did find is Herodotus, the historian, apparently studied, he was in the 400s, the 500s to 400s BCE, and the Purim story happens in the mid-300s BCE, 366, according to the timeline that we had. And so his records are preceding the Purim story by like 150 years, say. Okay, and what he records about the ancient Persians is that they did have a thing with drinking. He doesn't say anything about a giant cup and being forced to drink from it. He says they were really into drinking. And it seems that they were one of the most ancient cultures that produced wine like en masse as a massive, major, countrywide, you know, kingdom-wide export. And so they were very proud of their wine. And apparently the men were very macho about their wine. And he says, then this is something to think about for the next stage of the story, which we're not going to get to today, but, you know, part of the same conversation. According to Herodotus, the Persian leadership used to think wine was very good for clarity of the mind, and they would dafka make important decisions when they were drunk. Now, like, the historical commentary that I read on the history said, it doesn't make so much sense for such powerful world leaders to make decisions when they were drunk, so, like, maybe there are some suggestions that they drank a lot, but they had a concept of moderation, so they felt that wine in the right moderation, making them have a clear mind, and then they would make good decisions. But what do? He says they would make important decisions when they were drunk, and then the next day when they weren't drunk, they would reconsider the decision.
Right.
Sound familiar, anyone?
Well, yeah.
Vashti, right?
Right.
Interesting. apparently it wasn't so crazy for him to make this law when he was drunk and then reconsider the next day. The problem was it wasn't reversible. So like it didn't work. And then he had a problem. That's the whole rest of the story. But this is like the backdrop of it. And apparently, and it's so interesting because the Dafka, this whole Purim is based on a culture that was obsessed with wine. Interesting. Purim, interesting. Okay, what do we do with the wine? It's a different story. There's the Persian version of wine and then there's the Jewish version of wine. Okay, something to think about. It was a thing. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Come to a party. Well, like, why don't they just have a meeting in the office? You know? No, you have to have wine. This is the thing.
The party was called Mishteh.
Yes, Milasho and Shtiya, exactly. It was part and parcel of the concept. Even though we just said, at this party, he wanted to have more food than the drink because he wanted to be similar to Jewish practice, but really, it was all about the wine in the culture and in general. And for him, personally, we see that... when on the seventh day it says when his heart was merry with wine, that he was still attached to the wine, even though he made the party for the Jewish kind of way.
So, in a sense, this image that we have of Achashverosh being this like merry drunkard, it's that would have been the ideal back then, according to Persian culture.
Presumably.
And that would have, in a sense, made him more powerful. Like, if he's, making a lot of assumptions here, but if he was a person who could really hold his drink,
so actually, yeah. Yeah, so because you said that, we can jump ahead in the Gemara for a second when we get to Vashti, which we're not up to yet. But here, the second Gemara page that I copied for you, the last, like the line underneath the line is commentary, above the line is the Gemara.
If they could reconsider their big decisions, then why did they kill her right away?
Ah, so this is where the Purim story differs a little bit from the cultural norm. That was apparently the cultural norm. And I can't remember who said this. Also, like, forgive my way if this is not the way I usually give a shiur. I'm usually a little bit more medactic on which source, like quoting the sources, but in the books that I was reading on the go, there was a parish that said that dafka that's tashgacha pratis here. That wasn't normal.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that there was some person that had a grudge against Vashti and made sure that,
That was one aspect of Hashgacha Pratis that he should have reconsidered. Then he could have written it down on a piece of paper in his law book or whatever, and then the next day he probably would have said, "Oh, actually, I'm going to erase that. I'm going to cross that out." But that's not what happened. It was quick, impulsive. There was something different going on here. Okay.
But so, also, yeah. It should be, as you said, if there is some kind of sense of moderation, that at that point.
Past that point of moderation, possibly too.
Right.
Yes, could be also.
And that's why it specifically points out.
Maybe that is what was different. Maybe the difference that maybe the Ashkacha was in the fact that he let himself get too drunk, where he couldn't have that norm of the way it was supposed to go in those times, and instead he went too far. Yeah, that could be another. Definitely could be.
Culturally, it wasn't acceptable what he did.
Right. Okay. So if you look at the second Gemara page, the last paragraph above the line, the last part that's quoted there. It says, why was Achashverosh so mad when Vashti said, "No, I'm not coming"? What was her line to him? And this is, by the way, the source of that midrash that people quote and know about, but don't know where it came from. Vashti's words to him when she refused were, "Bar ahur yare," excuse my Aramaic, "Bar ahur yare de Abba, you stable boy of my father." We've heard of the stable boy thing, right? The Gemara is the source of that. That's what she said. Abba lekabel alfa chamra shate velo rabbe. My father drank wine as much as 1,000 people drink, and he didn't get drunk. Yeah. It was a thing, yeah. Right? It was like a cultural sign of machoism to be able to hold a lot of liquor. And then he goes on, v'ho gavra ishtate b'chamre, but you, Achashverosh, you become a fool. You get drunk so easily. Look what happened to you. You're saying these wacky things. You want me to come?
So she was insulting his manhood.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, she was.
Yeah.
Well said. Okay, and then when he heard this, miyad v'chamato barabo. That was too much. You don't insult the macho manhood of the king, of the dictator who rose himself up to power, right? That was a big insult. So that's kind of support for this theory and a proof from the Gemara. Okay. And again, it's very interesting to think about the role of wine in Purim in contrast to that whole cultural backdrop. And I want to thank you, Chani, for inspiring me to look up more in the history than I might have, because that's a very important piece, it turns out. Okay.
I'd like to make one last comment about that, on that topic. Until rather recently, the people who were in charge were usually intoxicated to some extent, because alcoholic beverages were the only things that were safe to drink.
Water.
People didn't know about boiling water until very recently, and most of what they drank made them ill. So almost everybody drank fermented beverages. The distillation only came about much later, more recently, like maybe a little bit before people knew about boiling water and germs and so on. But before that, you had all sorts of fermented drinks, from honey, from, you know, and poor people drank, they didn't drink wine, they didn't have the money for wine, but they drank other kinds of fermented beverages from the minute they got up in the morning until they went to bed at night. And of course, most of the people, the life expectancy of people in those days was very, very short. So you really, the world was basically run by a bunch of 15-year-old men who were walking around drunk.
Interesting. I don't know if I would go that far.
No.
In other words,
you can read this in history books.
I mean, besides for Persian culture, I don't think world leaders made their decisions when they were drunk, usually. But it wasn't abnormal for people to drink.
It was very common and day-long. Uh-huh.
I was just thinking because you're saying, let's say they weren't so much physically bigger, I don't know, they could have been over there.
Interesting. I mean,
they didn't have other drinks.
They
could make their tea and drink.
But if you have to drink that much of,
interesting.
I'm not a
bucky
on ancient drink habits.
And maybe they did not like those things until much, much later.
Probably
it was a very new invention.
Well, China probably had it, but not in Persia.
I don't know about Persia.
Right. I'm not a bucky in ancient drinking,
Europe,
non-alcoholic drinking practices. I'm not sure. Interesting. Interesting.
And that's why people drank tea, by the way.
Because it wasn't the...
Because it was boiled.
Oh.
And because it didn't make the
interesting. Right. Interesting. Michal, are you going to say something?
Not all wine is necessarily as strong as,
Though I think also it's more of a modern thing, the less
wine might just be like
watered down. They used to water down
winey-ish drink to obviously a more sophisticated and intoxicating wine.
Not my forte, so I can't elaborate on the very specifics of the nature of the drinks. But
why can't they just drink grape juice?
I don't know. I think they invented grape juice.
I think it's the fermentation issue.
Yeah.
There was no refrigeration. Yeah.
Right.
Like,
I can't comment more on that, on the ancient drinking beverages, but I'll have to take all your words for it. I want to mention one other thing I forgot to mention about the Maharal, that on the whole line of being creators, the Kelim Shonim, the Maharal says another thing about Shonim. Lehishtanot means to change. And it doesn't only mean that they were milashon of repeating, like the Gemara had said, but the Maharal also says it relates to the word changing, that they would switch the cups, the kelim, they would use to drink from, and whoever, that was part of the fanciness, but also whoever had a cup, they got to take it home afterward. That was their souvenir. And he says this is because, again, he wanted to be like a creator. Hashem provides things. God, whatever Achashverosh called him, provides things in the world. He makes things grow. He gives us crops and animals and all sorts of things. He doesn't like take it back. He gives it and we take it and we keep it and that's it. And so too, Achashverosh wanted him to be in the persona of a creator and a sustainer. And here I am. Here are all these things I'm providing you, and you may have it, and that is yours, and you don't have to. And they were made fancy things, right? Exactly. They were, you know, expensive things, and it's all yours because I have everything, and I'm the sustainer, and that is for you. What's that? Collector's items, a souvenir from your Shushan party.
I just have to give Achashverosh quote credit just for a pause. I find it fascinating that as a non-Jew and someone connected to the world of Tuma, almost admittedly, he has a deep understanding of the God of Jews. I mean,
yes.
Do you see how much thought and contemplation he's being inspired by, essentially, but like he has a deep, like, bina. He understands how the nature of a Jew works, that Bechira is most connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I mean, to understand, we're learning from Achashverosh's
right.
understanding,
right?
And he's teaching me. I mean, it's odd.
Yeah.
It's odd.
Interesting. I think it was a little bit.
Was that general knowledge, though, back then? Was that
the god of
Tartarus? I don't know this degree of it. It wasn't the craziest thing. Like, nowadays, we think it's, wow, and Anju knows about Jewish things. That's so cool. You know, in those days, like, Nebuchadnezzar and Balak and Bilam, like, they did know certain things. What were the Jews allowed to do? What are they not allowed to do? Let's make them sin. Let's, like, you know, there was more of an awareness of the god of the Jews and ramifications of that. It seems, I don't think I've heard of this degree of familiarity and detail of it.
It's because the Jews were so untouchable.
Well, also, there were a lot of Jews.
It's a phenomenon.
They had,
yeah. Right? In other words,
you're secular Jews. How untouchable must we be perceived at this time?
Well, there were a lot of Jews in Ahasuerus' court. Like, Daniel was there, and Mordechai was obviously there.
Right. There is, in other words, that wasn't that long after the Churban Beis Hamikdash. Yeah. It really wasn't, because they thought it was the end of 7 years, and it wasn't quite. Yeah. So even if by this point in the Gaulus the Jews were fell, it was just a couple generations ago they had the Beis Hamikdash, and the whole world knew it. So on one hand, it's still striking, 100%. It is striking. On the other hand, it wasn't the most unusual thing the way we perceive it nowadays.
They had to figure out how to get us to not be so untouchable.
Well, right, that's exactly the point.
In terms of bringing our connection with what makes us untouchable,
yes,
which is the Kodesh
Baruch. Exactly.
But it could also be that he had some Jewish source that was helping him out.
It could be he interrogated his Jewish, with lowercase I.
It could be that they were defectors.
Yeah, it could be. We don't know about that, but definitely could be, because, like you said, there were Jews who were in the court. Definitely, you know, it's not surprising that he might have found these things out. He had his sources that weren't that far away from him. Yeah.
It's more surprising if a leader like Sanherib or Nebuchadnezzar would know these things, because there weren't Jews there.
Yeah.
Whereas,
they hadn't conquered them yet.
Whereas Ahasuerus, who was the king of all the cultures then,
they were already under the
right. And according to
rulership of
the
Luke,
so right.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And one other thing, also talking about these different approaches, it's really, you know, we basically set up two main perspectives on the party. We set up the Ahasuerus wants to be godly kingdom on earth, Maharal perspective. We set up the Ahasuerus wants to make the Jews sin, Gilstar perspective. And again, these themes are following us through the psukim of this party scene, where we have the Kelim Shonim may be part of Lishtanot, of changing, of the creator, sustainer, Maharal perspective, or the Gilstar actually says, Kelim Shonim is a subtle way of referring to ladies, different kinds of ladies that were present, which he already established was part of the plan of his party and the way he's trying to make the Jews sin and that whole scene there. So depending on what the approach is, all these things follow through. Okay, and let's see what else. So we have the Kedat. Okay, the Gemara, let's go back to the Gemara. Let me sort of stop in the middle there. Okay, so Enonase, if you see those words, they weren't forced to. Now we know from Rashi what the background was, why you might think they were forced to, and now what the chiddush in them not being forced to. This is the bechira involved and choosing to sin. But the Gemara specifically says, Milame chekol echad v'echad hishko miyayin medinato. Each one had the wine of his own medina. And one way to understand this is that their own medina is the wine that they knew how much they could handle. So on one hand, you have the model of the giant cup, where it doesn't matter how much wine you can handle, be macho and drink it up, you know. On the other hand, he's doing something very different. Maybe he's providing the big cup, so he looks like he's rich, but he's saying, you know, this is your wine, drink however much you want, you know. And each person would say, okay, I know I can handle this much of my wine, and that's my choice because I'm choosing how much. It's not like they had no idea what they were getting themselves into. You know, again, it's the same Bechira idea. It's a way to gauge,
I
yeah.
No, I mean, as in the word medina, it's like,
I don't think that's the indication here. It's an interesting thought. I think it's literal, their own place of origin, because people came from different places,
but
even though it's the Shushan.
It would make more sense if that was the original.
Right. I was thinking that too. I didn't see anything explaining that. Maybe it means whatever they, like, the origin of the wine they like to drink, perhaps. But the indication is that it's that this is it has to, the Kliyakar, we're not getting into it a lot, but he suggests this in the source that we talked about last time, that the point was for them not to get drunk. And if they want to get drunk, it's trying to get drunk. But the point was, we see all this choice, the choosing Kedat Ish V'Ish, and also Enonis, that they weren't forced to drink a large amount, means that he wasn't encouraging people to get drunk. Why? Again, Yael Starim, what do you want them to do? He wanted them to choose to sin, to choose to be a part of this party that's celebrating no more Beis HaMikdash. If everyone get drunk, again, they're not as liable. So he purposely changed the norms of how Persian parties were to encourage the option of people not getting drunk and being clear-headed in their sinning. It's part of the same picture.
It's interesting that in Purim, we do the opposite, that
the Messiah is drinking because he's no longer. Yeah, exactly. And I think that this is, it's an irony, but it kind of makes sense. In other words, usually we want to be like that. Usually Judaism wants us to have our head on straight and a clear mind and consciousness and choice made as choose, you know, not just going by default, by, that's what I'm trying to think of, you know, we press the automatic button. We're supposed to make choices. However, Dafka on Purim, the choice was twisted. That was tumified. The exact point of Bechira. So if you're going to tumify Bechira, let's Mekadesh the not Bechira.
So cool.
It's a crazy thing.
So cool.
But also the not Bechira could be Mekadesh. Right? Everything can be elevated. Everything, even the thing that we think is Dafka Lehefech, you're not supposed to do that. That's not Judaism. We don't just go on autopilot. That's what I was trying to do, autopilot. Right? No, sometimes autopilot is Kadosh, if it's the right autopilot. If it's the right autopilot, right? Nichnas Yayin, that's a sod. If your sod is a good sod, then it's okay to Nichnas Yayin. If you have your deep internals in the right place, in the right direction, sometimes you go on autopilot.
Yeah, sometimes people are like way more holy when they drink.
That exactly.
Yeah.
Or that's exactly the idea.
Not necessarily more holy, but more revealed.
More revealed holy. Interesting.
Right.
It's a big, to me, that's like a huge chiddush of the whole thing. Because when do we ever have that? That you're supposed to, like, there's a Kedusha in not thinking.
It's
but
inhibition.
Yeah. So if it's the right way for the right person, not too much, that's dangerous. But, you know, exactly. Okay, so we have this interesting purposeful allowance of people's free choice. Seen a couple different times. This is really interesting to me. The idea of Kirtzon Ish Va'ish, right? What did the Gemara say? The Gemara says the next phrase, Latzot Kirtzon Ish Va'ish. Rava says Kirtzon Mordechai V'Haman. What's that supposed to mean? Why? You know, we already said one understanding of that Gemara on a simple level, that he didn't only want everyone to be like Haman to sin, he wanted the option of Mordechai to be available so everyone could sin consciously. But it's more than that. The Mefarshim say that Ish Va'ish maybe is a prototype for any tzaddik in Russia. Mordechai and Haman represent, you want to be a tzaddik, be a tzaddik, you want to be a Russia, be a Russia. But it also is specific to what Mordechai's mindset was at this party and what Haman's mindset was at this party.
I thought Mordechai didn't go.
So this is really interesting because that's also like one of those things that people say he didn't go and it would make sense and it's possible. But is this in the Gemara that I copied for you?
Yeah,
right, so this is a commentary in the Gemara, actually. It's on the footnote 60, actually. Rashi says, no, Mordechai was a cupbearer. Mordechai helped plan this thing. You were saying they had kosher food. Well, someone Jewish and from and who knew kashrus must have been involved in planning this feast. Maybe it was Mordechai. Dafka. That's not the story I was told when I went to grade school, right? Why should Mordechai do that? Why?
It's more confusing because then what can the Jews be held accountable for?
Totally.
Right.
And we spent this whole time describing in elaborate detail all the problems of this party, and then suddenly we're saying they didn't have anybody telling them what the right choice is.
Right, so since it's here, actually, look at the footnote 60 on the first Gemara page that I gave you. It's the footnote from the phrase in the Gemara where it says, Laso Kirton Ish Va'ish, Amarava, Laso Kirton Mordechai V'Haman. Right? And the commentary, the bolded in English is the actual Gemara, and the non-bolded is usually a commentary on the Gemara from somewhere. So here it actually explains that for you. It says, this is Rashi's interpretation, that the cupbearers were to comply with the wishes of Mordechai and Haman. Maybe he wasn't actually the cupbearer, maybe he informed what was going to happen at the party, but he definitely, according to this, he had some involvement in it. He didn't just say, run away, go away, have nothing to do with it, I have nothing to do with it. No, he had something to do with it. However, the Maharsha argues that the cupbearers had been directed by Ahasuerus to fulfill the specific requests of each individual guest. So maybe it means Haman and Mordechai, maybe it means literally Ish V'Ish. The Marsha therefore follows the interpretation of the Targum that Ish V'Ish refers to Mordechai and Haman, as representatives of their respective nations, who would determine what food and drink should be served to their people. In other words, maybe it's general of each person of their own culture, but apparently Haman and Mordechai are, even if you say that, they're the representatives. They're the model through which we know that each group of people.
But you still have Mordechai's name attached to it. It's like when you're on a plane and you're,
right,
you're getting your kosher meal, and right, you're getting, so it still had that like Mordechai seal on it.
Right. So what's this Rashi explanation going on to say? Thus, Mordechai was able to strike from the Jews' menu all forbidden foods, whereas Haman was able to provide the idolaters with every imaginable delicacy. According to this, if Ahasuerus wanted to do things also according to Mordechai's will, that means Mordechai was involved in the menu or maybe even in serving it, and he, Dafka, could plan to have the option of kosher food. Wait a minute. We just said, he's trying to make them sin with free choice. They're having kosher food, Dafka, so they will choose not to eat the kosher food. This interpretation of the Gemara, which is also, I found in a book by Mendel Weinbach, I don't really know anything about him, I just have a book by him. If you know about him, feel free to chime in. But he has this book kind of elaborating on different agadatas on the Megillah, and he explains it this way. He probably got it from Rashi. But he explains that, what did Mordechai have in mind here? It's on Ish v'Ish. The Midrash goes on this whole thing. It's a long Midrash, and it says, how can you say, Kirtzon Ish v'Ish, Mordechai and Haman, the Gemara says, how could Ahasuerus possibly please Mordechai and Haman at the same time? They're like opposite ends of the spectrum. And the Gemara goes through all these mashals of like opposite things that can't happen at the same time to illuminate this point. And the point is, how could Ahasuerus do that? What scenario would you have where both Mordechai and Haman would be pleased? The answer is, give the option of kosher food and non-kosher food. Why? Haman was like we just said. You'll start. Haman says, great, let's let them have Bechira Chavshis. Like the commentary on the Megillah seems to describe that as Ahasuerus' perspective. This Rashi seems to interpret as Haman's perspective. It was the same perspective. Give the option of kosher food. Jews will still sin willingly. We'll be able to get away with literally murder because it's their fault and they deserve it. And Hashem will strike them down. Mordechai says, I know, let's provide them with kosher food. Maybe they'll choose the kosher food. Maybe they'll make the right bechira. And to me, this was like mind-blowing. Two commentaries are saying the exact opposite. Like, was it Haman says, provide kosher food and then they will sin? Or Mordechai says, provide kosher food and they will not sin. Dafka, and that's why Mordechai was involved in the party in the first place, to encourage Bnei Yisrael to keep halacha. I know, we just said, Lubavitcher Rebbe says, Mordechai was also the Jew who represented not only halacha, but he still cared about halacha. And how do we think about Jewish people? How do we think about ourselves? Right? What's going to happen if we have free will? Do we assume the worst in ourselves or in other people and say, give them the option, don't worry, they'll sin? Or do we say, give them the option, at least they have the option, maybe they'll choose good, have hope in people, believe in ourselves?
Yeah, but that's not the principle that we follow. We say that we don't put ourselves in a situation where we could possibly sin. And Mordechai here was...
Okay. Well, what was Mordechai doing, though? If Mordechai hadn't been involved, what would the party be?
He's trying to save the day.
Because everybody goes to a party, and you, like, if somebody goes to a cocktail party for work or whatever, and they know everything is not kosher, they're not going to even try. But if they look, and they're like, oh, I see there's fruit over there, maybe they'll just try the fruit, and, like, it starts to add more complications. But if you know that everything there is not kosher, you're not even going to try.
But why were they at the party in the first place?
Yeah,
if the people were really upright people, and they knew about this party, what was going on, what the purpose of it was, they probably wouldn't have gone. Now, did people know if Mordechai was involved in the menu before coming? I don't know. None of these sources tend to suggest that to me, one way or the other. But whoever was there already didn't really care so much about celebrating the end of the Beis HaMikdash and the Gullus going on eternally. So they already were not the greatest level of people, probably. Maybe some officials, maybe, who felt obligated, but by and large, probably not. And Mordechai being there provided an opening for at least there to be some merit. Yeah. Some merit of something. And again, where we saw the Gemara said, perhaps one of the possibility of why they deserved the Gezeirah in the first place was coming to the party. Here, Mordechai is like providing some redeeming value, at least, a little bit.
I think that's it's a very big hashkacha statement. About how you approach a situation, right? Because it's like saying, okay, come drive on Shabbos.
I was just thinking that example, yes. And not every rabbi is going to, you know, in modern day comparison, that's not a simple thing to say. Well, there are those who say, interesting.
Yes, because...
Yeah, but did Mordechai also provide, like, a a devartor or something like that? Like,
don't think so. Don't think so. I don't think Ahasuerus would have let that fly.
The party was not the food. So if they eaten pig, what? They just had eaten not kosher. But that's a minor infringement in according with the other things they could have done there.
So I'm not sure.
He avoided.
What?
So every avera that he could, like,
so here's the thing. I'm going to give a not comparable example. Right? Not comparable example. Do not take this as a comparison. Okay? Only in a very small sense that I trust you will understand what I mean. Is it hypocritical for a woman to wear pants and cover her hair? There's this and there's that. And we have free choice. And someone can choose this and someone can choose that in two different areas. So
and then chooses to present herself in a certain way, she's making a statement. She's saying this is something that's okay.
So you're saying wasn't it Maris Ayin that Mordechai was there at all, yeah, even if he was doing something that was redeemable?
Yeah, I think it's worse. I think, because again, I think eating kosher, it's not good. I mean, eating not kosher is not good, but it's not as bad as the other things that were going on at the party.
So here's the thing. Now, again, the Zonas is a commentary. It's not clear. It's all commentary. The Zonas isn't the same commentary as the Gemara and the Rashi. You could say that Midrash, we'll get to Midrashim approach, probably not today. But
who are we to decide what's a worse?
So here's the thing. I'm thinking about the Lubavitch Rebbe statement and this idea that there's like letter of the law and spirit of the law. And that Mordechai Dafka represents spirit of the law. It's funny, he ends up the piece that where he brings, I don't want to bring out that specific idea in the shir, but it happens to be that at the end of the piece where he says that idea, he ends up concluding you need both and one's not contradicted to the other and it's possible to do both at the same time. And the point is that the goal of celebrating the end of the Beis HaMikdash, is that an avera? Halachically? I'm not sure. There are mefarshim that say that even using the kelim based on mikdash wasn't necessarily usher, even though normally kadoshim things that were kadoshim based on mikdash we don't use in a whole kind of way. But some mefarshim say that because they were already tumified and cholified by Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, so they already fell down their level of kedusha, and so it wasn't actually usher for the Jews to use them. So it could be that it wasn't technically usher. There maybe there weren't worse things that they were doing. Maybe it was the spirit of the law. Well, which is more important, the letter of the law, spirit? You know, the point is he was trying to bring out redeeming value in the situation and in the Jews. And he believed in people enough that at least his statement, again, it's hard to tell. We don't know how public it was. Maybe the impression I haven't learned, I can't say for sure. But, you know, how public was it really known that Mordechai himself was the one who provided for it? I'm not sure. Obviously, it was known there was kosher food there. So people had the choice. It's controversial. It's definitely controversial. Well, if the Gemara says that one reason for the Gezeirah was that they enjoyed the party, then presumably some people didn't choose well.
I wonder, like, percentages and what, whatever.
But the thing is, there has to be a bigger factor there than whether they chose to eat kosher food or choose not to eat kosher food. Like, I mean, yes, that's a sin, but it's not, it's like, it's food. It's not, there's something bigger than there.
To me, the only way that this makes sense is if you say that the Jews went bonus. If you say that they were forced to go, then it would make sense that Mordechai would try to do whatever he could do to make it more possible, acceptable. And it would also be more of a sin if they enjoyed themselves.
You know what I'm thinking about? What? Are you familiar with Rabbi Grossman, Yitzhak Grossman? What he used to do? He's head of a big... That exactly. What he used to do, I don't think he does it anymore, he's a little too old for that app, but he used to go into discos in like secular cities in Israel and go in the middle of the dance floor and like join the party. But then why was he there in the first place? He is giving the message. There's a big rub at a disco party, well, it must be okay. You see, the frum Jews, he went on Friday nights. The frum Jews weren't at the disco. They weren't about to go to the disco. And they weren't about to say, oh, look, Rabbi Grossman's at the disco, so that means I can go to the disco. That wasn't the message that he was sent to anybody. It's a cure of tact. And that's how I interpret this. That the Jews who really had their heads on straight, they knew Mordechai wasn't approving of the party. And they weren't going to the party. The Jews who already didn't care about the Beis HaMikdash and were going to the party, Mordechai is there. There's kosher food. Could be, who cares? Maybe somebody would say, oh, maybe it's okay that I'm here, Mordechai's here. Just like maybe someone would say, oh, Rabbi Grossman's here. See, it's good to go to disco party on Friday nights. Probably not, though, or more likely not, though. Even if there's a chance to open the door for someone saying that, I think the majority of people wouldn't interpret it that way. Whoever was there, it was opening the door for mitzvahs and tshuva and that sort of thing.
In my head, it's a bigger, conflict to have Mordechai on the other side, where you have the gadol dor who's clearly saying, don't go to the party, versus, and then it's a matter of, do the people choose to listen to our rabbanim, or do they choose to do what, you know, moves naturally, what they want to do, the rav of the town, he says, okay, everything's kosher, and all they're doing is choosing between, do they want to eat kosher, or not kosher. Like, it seems to, like,
doesn't sit well.
The conflict. Like, we're talking about the destruction of the Jewish people. Like, the entire nation is going to be destroyed because they chose to eat pork.
So to me, that's what the God, in other words, Dafka the godless, is he's trying to find their redeeming value where it seems like it's not redeemable. In other words, yeah, you're right. Pork is not going to save them. And they had the gazer anyway. Proof right there. There's your proof. You're right. The kosher food didn't save them. They went to the party. They had the wrong values. They were celebrating on the Beis Mikdash. And they had the gazera. You're right. But the gazera didn't happen. It did something. It did something. And I just think it provides a very interesting perspective for us to think about. It's definitely controversial, but definitely food for thought that I think is worth considering. Okay? We've only a tiny bit of time left.
It's known to them that Mordechai did that, though. We're saying, hey...
Right, that's what I was saying, is that I'm not sure. I'm honestly not sure.
But also, Mordechai was a controversial figure. The entire time, he was, like, opposing Haman, and everybody else was, like, going along...
So that's the thing, that obviously people knew that he didn't really approve of this party. I think it was obvious to everyone. I think the fact that he was going only sent one message, which is... try to find a place in your heart for Torah. Find a little space in your heart for Hashem, for mitzvahs. I think he was known for who he was. I don't think people really thought that he approved of the party.
To me, it seems more like a mixed message. It's like...
You would have been confused.
I don't like...
You would have run away.
I don't like...
You would not have been the Jews, Hanimtsaim, Bishush, and Haviar, who were still there.
Like,
you would have been somewhere else.
I would not have been tempted to go at all.
Awesome. Excellent. Wonderful. Okay.
It's 9:25.
It is 9:25, so we are going to stop here. We're going to stop here, and we're going to look forward to Vashti next week.
Okay,
Shakar, thank you, everyone, for coming.